Welcome back. Our next presentation is Psychosis in Neurodegenerative Disorders, and that will be provided by Dr. Dylan Wendt. Dr. Wendt earned his undergraduate and medical degrees at Stanford University and the University of Miami. His postgraduate training includes residencies in neurology and psychiatry, a research fellowship, and a deep brain stimulation fellowship at the University of Florida, and an integrated neuroimaging fellowship at the National Institutes of Health. As a faculty member at Emory University, he developed a clinical research and educational unit dedicated to optimizing the understanding, diagnosis, and treatment of behavioral problems in patients with neurologic illnesses. Since 2010, Dr. Wendt has directed the education department at the Cleveland Clinic, Lou Ruva Center for Brain Health here in Las Vegas. The department provides learning and mentorship opportunities for K-12, college, and professional students, has started 4 fellowship programs, offers educational programs for patients, caregivers, and the general community, and presents multiple interdisciplinary continuing education programs for medical professionals. And now I present Dr. Wendt.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for the kind introduction, Leanne. So I'm here to talk about psychosis in neurodegenerative disorders. This is one of those symptoms that affects a lot of the neurodegenerative disorders, especially the more common ones, and is also extremely distressing to patients and to their caregivers. As you've probably heard a few times today, a lot of times, particularly in dementia, it's not the primary neurological component that's as distressing to patients and caregivers as these other components that we tend to refer to as non-degenerative, but they actually are part of the degeneration. So in my talk today, I'm going to focus mostly on psychosis and dementias. That's frankly where we see psychosis the most in neurologic disease, particularly in Alzheimer's disease and the Lewy body diseases. So that includes dementia with Lewy bodies and Parkinson's disease, from which dementia can also develop. And then a little bit about psychosis in other neurodegenerative processes, secondary psychosis, and what we can do about psychosis once it shows up in our patients. So at least 30% of dementia patients have psychosis symptoms. And typically, this is meant to include hallucinations, which are perceptual abnormalities, where someone's brain creates a perception, auditory, visual, gustatory, olfactory, but it creates a perception of something that is not there. And the other main psychosis symptom is delusions. So delusions are fixed, false beliefs for which there is no or minimal evidence in real life. There are other symptoms of psychosis that can be considered, but when we're talking about psychosis and dementia, these are the symptoms we're usually talking about, hallucinations and delusions. We do see these across all dementia types, although they're more common in some dementia types than in others. And the longer the disease goes on, the more likely you are to have hallucinations and delusions. Once they show up, hallucinations and delusions tend to hang around. They can get better, get worse over the course of a day, over the course of months, over the course of years. But typically, once someone develops some psychosis symptoms, assuming that it's not due to a secondary cause like a medication or delirium, you can expect to see the psychosis again. And in some cases, the presence of psychosis can have a diagnostic value. In other words, the nature of the psychotic symptom can actually tell us a little bit about what the underlying cause is. So as I mentioned, we see psychosis across the dementias, and here are the more common ones. So in Alzheimer's disease, we're looking at a rate of about 30%. And note that in Alzheimer's disease, delusions are a little bit more common than hallucinations. In cerebrovascular dementia, lower rates, as is the case with frontotemporal dementia, and in both of those, hallucinations are more common. But when you look at Lewy body disease, you have very, very high rates of both hallucinations and delusions, and you'll notice that hallucinations are much more common in Lewy body disease than are delusions. Psychosis, when it does appear in older people, is associated with poorer outcomes. So community-dwelling elders who have psychosis symptoms are more likely to experience cognitive decline in the ensuing years after their psychosis symptoms appear. And that makes sense. Psychosis does represent some degree of brain change. And in older people, the most common reasons for brain change are degenerative diseases. Psychosis in people who have dementia is associated with a more rapid progression from mild or moderate to a severe dementia stage, meaning, you know, essentially dependent for all ADLs. And in people who have been recently diagnosed with dementia at any stage, if psychosis is present also, they are going to die more quickly. So psychosis either is evidence of more severe brain disease, or perhaps it tends to drive or kindle further degeneration, or it could be both, that people have more severe disease, they develop psychosis, something about the effect of psychosis on the brain, directly or indirectly, kind of encourages further degeneration. Of course, this is not something we can do in sort of a completely controlled study, so we probably will never have the complete answer to which is the chicken and which is the egg there. So in dementia, there are certain delusions that are common and others that are not so common. And one way to think of the ones that are common is that a lot of them seem to be related to the loss of memory. So delusions of theft, often those result from the fact that the person with dementia leaves objects in places, they don't remember where they left them. And since we all know objects don't get up and walk away, well, someone must have taken it if it's not where I put it. Similarly, delusions of jealousy. Someone who doesn't remember where their spouse said they were going or why their spouse hasn't been there for a few hours, or even thinking it's been a few hours when it's only been a few minutes, and then being suspicious because the spouse who is intact insists that, no, it was just a few minutes. The tendency when you have a fixed false belief is to think that other people who are in disagreement, let's say, with that belief, are either lying or they are ignorant. And so if someone is giving you a different story about where they've been from the story you know about where they've been, well, you're going to think that that's lying. The delusion of the phantom boarder, that someone is in the house doing various things, don't know why. The things that they're doing don't really make much sense. Moving furniture around, moving my objects around, hiding some of my stuff. But there must be someone else in the house because that's the only way to explain the dissonance between what is happening out in the world and what I understand about the way the world is supposed to work. There are these misidentification delusions, which can be seen in schizophrenias also. So Capgras and Fregoli delusions. So Capgras is the belief that a familiar person has been replaced by an imposter. And the Fregoli is kind of the opposite, that there is this spirit or individual going around who's serially inhabiting the bodies of or pretending to be familiar people that you know. Reduplicative paramnesia is the thought that something is pretty much exactly like something else, but it's not the same. So a classic one for this is people with dementia, and I see this particularly in Lewy body dementia, who believe that the house that their spouse keeps bringing them to, the house that they're now in, is not really their house. It looks a lot like it. It's a very clever, clever duplicate, but it's not actually the house that I'm supposed to live in. And some of my patients have even gone so far as to say the house next door is the one that they live in. And then delusions of persecution, that someone's doing something to harm you purposely for their own misguided purposes. Uncommon in dementia are grandiose delusions, erotomanic delusions, these first rank symptoms, as they were called, of thought broadcasting, thought insertion. You know, thought broadcasting is that when I think, everyone else can hear what I'm thinking, or a lot of people can hear what I'm thinking, or thought insertion or removal, that someone is putting thoughts into my head or pulling thoughts out of my head before I can express them, and thought reading, that other people can, you know, read your mind. Cotard delusion, we don't see this a lot in dementia. This is where people believe that their body or some part of it is rotting away. And then delusions of reference, that general statements or general occurrences out in the world mean something specific for us. You know, there's been a lot of crime in Las Vegas, and the person thinks that they are the target of these crimes, or that maybe they're being accused of committing these crimes. So we don't see these a lot in dementia. And right after I say that, I'm going to say I've seen every one of these in at least one demented patient. So there's no hard and fast rule. But when you do see these, you have to think hard about whether there might be a primary psychiatric disturbance or perhaps a delirium. Hallucinations in dementia tend to be visual as the most common modality, but we can see all kinds of modalities. If you see enough people with dementia, you are certain to see people with tactile hallucinations where they feel like bugs are biting them, and certainly auditory hallucinations as well. Typically, in folks with dementia, the visual hallucinations in particular tend to be much more detailed, so that when the individual describes what they're seeing, it's not vague, you know. So in schizophrenia, you might hear about people seeing an angel, and you ask them what it looked like. Oh, it was a bright light. Well, man or woman, it was hard to tell. In dementia, visual hallucinations tend to be quite detailed. They can tell you what the person looked like, what color their hair was, what clothes they were wearing. On the other hand, in people with dementia, the hallucinations they have tend to not fit into a delusional system per se. So in schizophrenia, psychotic bipolar disorder, psychotic depression, usually the hallucination fits into an overall worldview, an overall delusional or hallucinatory worldview. Whereas in dementia, they will often tend to be much more random. You know, I had a patient who, and probably some of you have heard this before, who would see 5 ugly transvestites, and it bothered him to no end, but there was no delusional content. He didn't think anyone was putting them there. He just saw them, didn't really recognize them as not being real, and was frustrated by them, but they didn't fit into any sort of cabal of transvestites trying to harm him or bother him in some way. The timing of psychosis in dementia, this is important to note. So what we've got here is a plot that shows when dementia symptoms show or psychosis symptoms show up in relation to diagnosis, which is right here. So anything to the left is before diagnosis, to the right is after. And then how prevalent each of these symptoms is at that point in time. And you'll see I've circled in red here the ones that can be considered psychosis symptoms. Paranoia and accusatory behavior. Paranoia and accusatory behavior often show up long before the diagnosis. You're looking at, you know, 15 months before diagnosis that people start feeling paranoid. You can see hallucinations and delusions show up within months of diagnosis, that we see delusions less than a year, hallucinations less than 2 years, and then other symptoms that are related to psychosis, such as agitation and aggression, also tend to show up pretty early as well. So in Alzheimer's disease specifically, this is a list of many behavioral symptoms, but when we look at delusions and hallucinations, the yellow is people with mild dementia, orange, moderate dementia, red, severe dementia. And you can see as you go from mild to moderate to severe, there's an increase in the prevalence of psychosis. But even early on in Alzheimer's disease, you are seeing in mild Alzheimer's dementia, 20% of people having hallucinations and or delusions. And usually both of these rise over time. In Lewy body disease, psychosis is part of the core diagnostic features. So about 80% of people with Lewy body diseases, so that's Parkinson's disease, dementia, and diffuse Lewy body disease, will have recurrent, well-formed visual hallucinations. Another symptom that is sometimes confused for psychosis is REM behavior disorder. So this is when people act out their dreams. They're asleep, but they're moving their bodies as if acting out the dream. And often they'll wake up. Well, not often. Sometimes they will wake up and describe what they were seeing in their dream, and it will be thought that they were having a hallucination, but it actually was a dream. So that can be present also, and actually REM behavior disorder is suggestive, and some people would say definitive, for the presence of synuclein, which is the protein that that comprises Lewy bodies. Supportive clinical features of Lewy body dementia also include psychosis. So both systematized delusions and non-visual hallucinations can be supportive clinical features that should suggest that you pursue the core diagnostic features when you see those pop up. In Lewy body psychosis, very often there will be sort of a prodrome to psychosis symptoms. People having a sense that someone else is in the room, so that's a present sensation, or that something is passing through the room. And they also can have hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, both auditory and visual. So hypnagogic and hypnopompic are when you're just in the act of waking up or in the act of falling asleep. Some of the early symptoms of psychosis that are not well-formed visual hallucinations, therefore they're not really meeting the diagnostic criteria. People will have visual illusions where an object that is real looks like something else that's not real, and it usually appears very convincing. So, a patient of mine would see a shadow on the floor and was sure it was his dog, and he'd reach out and then it'd be gone. Scintillations. So those are moving of the visual environment, often wavy lines, and then movement in things that shouldn't be moving. Another one of my patients, his first psychosis symptom was that the little syrup jars at IHOP would kind of move up and down as he was looking at them. They'd jump up, like suggesting which one he should take. Early on, people tend to see animals, particularly domestic animals and children. So the hallucinations tend to be of small living things. As it becomes more severe, we start to get more complexity to the hallucinations in terms of how many things are showing up at the same time and what they're doing. And then there becomes an increasing degree of lack of insight. Patients become more emotionally attached to these hallucinations and will respond more as if they're real. Things like not going to bed because they see someone in the bed, or not going in the bathroom and actually wetting their pants because they see someone in the bathroom. And of course, this leads to more disputes with the caregivers, who insist that what they're seeing isn't real. We don't see a lot of psychosis in these disorders that can cause cognitive dysfunction. B12 deficiency, I would say, maybe a bit of an exception. When I've seen people with B12 deficiency, actually a lot of them, I take that back. Psychosis is not uncommon in these other disorders. I was just looking at them and saying, no, these are all psychosis producing. Sorry about that. So all of these conditions can cause psychosis. Don't be necessarily thinking that something else is going on. If you see psychosis, say in multiple sclerosis or in someone with metachromatic leukodystrophy, because psychosis is far more common in the general population in these syndromes. Not so common in cerebrovascular dementia, as I showed you earlier. Frontotemporal dementia, there's sort of a split story there. Most people with frontotemporal dementia will not exhibit psychosis, but it's been seen relatively recently that people with this chromosome 9 mutation, who also have motor neuron disease or ALS, they tend to have high rates of psychosis. Progressive supranuclear palsy, one of the Parkinson's plus syndromes, as is corticobasal degeneration, will also typically not show hallucinations. Although delusions have been reported in progressive supranuclear palsy, unclear whether those might be people with the chromosome 9 open reading frame 72 mutation. So if you see delirium where you wouldn't expect it, if you see psychosis where you wouldn't expect it, or psychosis arising quickly, then think about delirium from a medical or metabolic problem. I'm not going to go through this whole list. It's the usual list, but think specifically about toxicities and about withdrawal from medications. In our population, the dementia population, dehydration and infection tend to be common causes of delirium. There are many ways we can produce psychosis in our neurodegenerative patients. So dopamine-enhancing drugs, both drugs that are direct dopamine agonists, as well as drugs that increase the amount of dopamine in the system, can cause psychosis symptoms. And we use those in Parkinson and Lewy body disease, as well as restless legs, and we sometimes use them in the Parkinson's plus syndromes like progressive supranuclear palsy. Anticholinergics, so if you start an anticholinergic drug for one of these patients and you see psychosis relatively soon after, don't be surprised if it's the drug. In fact, that's the first place you should look. You should also think about this in patients who don't necessarily have a degenerative disorder. A lot of people are out there using diphenhydramine and hydroxyzine over the counter to get sleep. Sedatives and opioids, of course, are used for pain and anxiety. We also see them used for insomnia. And sedatives are sometimes used for depression. So how do we go about treating? The first thing is to understand the goals of treatment. In most cases, completely eliminating the psychosis symptoms is going to be difficult, perhaps impossible. So you have to think in terms of the quality of life. How can we help this person function better? The person who is standing outside the bathroom wetting their pants because they think someone's in the bathroom, that's a big imposition on their quality of life. That's a big imposition on their level of comfort. The person who sees a cat walking by, the person who, as one of my mentors said, sees a squirrel driving a tractor. My mentor didn't say that. His patient said that. Sees a squirrel driving a tractor. Those are not really impairing function or impairing the person's level of comfort. So it's all about how much this gets in the way of the person feeling and functioning as well as they possibly could. And then, of course, this is different based on the patient and the caregiver that you're talking to. Not everyone will have the same goals of treatment. But remember, the goal is not the elimination of psychosis symptoms. Eliminating psychosis symptoms may be necessary to improve the quality of life, but it is not the end goal. First, minimize physiologic factors, of course. Dehydration, infection, electrolyte abnormalities, comorbidities that can contribute to delusions and hallucinations should be addressed. Also, sometimes these comorbidities will change the way that people interpret or respond to their hallucinations and delusions. So someone who becomes very anxious or someone who is very anxious, that anxiety may be driving their response to the hallucinations. And if they didn't have anxiety, perhaps the hallucination wouldn't be as troublesome. Also, see what you can do to improve the environment. And this is mostly about increasing the amount of clarity in the environment. So making sure there are not weird shadows, that the lighting is right, that when there is some sound going on, that we're clear about what the sound is. Don't have the TV running at a low volume so that it could sound like voices in another room. Activity has been shown to help. So keeping people active throughout the day reduces the likelihood of psychosis. And then by the same token, increasing the amount of input into their sensory systems, the amount of input into their cognitive symptoms, a simple way to think about it is that gives less room for the hallucinations and delusions to occupy their thoughts and occupy their perceptions. For Lewy body diseases in particular, again, Parkinson's disease, Lewy body disease, it's very important to avoid dopamine blockade. In the red are things that you really don't want to try to treat psychosis in these diseases. The yellow dots are things that may be helpful. The cholinesterase inhibitors, they do seem to provide some help in psychosis and Lewy body diseases and are very low risk. Ziprasidone, surprisingly, in an open study of use for hallucinations and Lewy body disease, there was no motor decline in those patients. I say surprising because it is a pretty potent dopamine blocker. It is also a potent serotonin blocker, so perhaps the serotonin blockade counteracts the effects of the dopamine blockade. Quetiapine is very attractive because it can be used for multiple purposes, right? So it has benefit for antidepressant augmentation. And of course, one of its side effects is sleep. Another side effect is appetite. So sometimes it serves a lot of purposes, but in terms of controlling hallucinations themselves, it doesn't seem to really show much in controlled studies. There is an FDA-approved drug for psychosis in Parkinson's disease, pimavanserin. So this is FDA-approved, and one nice thing about it is there is no dopamine blockade, and the side effects are pretty low if you look at them compared to placebo. The only places where you really see a significant difference are in peripheral edema and in confusional state. Clozapine's been out there for a long time, very effective in treating hallucinations and delusions, does not block dopamine to a great degree, but it does have a lot of side effects that go along with it. Three black box warnings, and then also drowsiness, sialorrhea, and weight gain. The antipsychotics in other dementias, Alzheimer's disease, if you do see it in frontotemporal dementia, can be useful. And they can also be useful to control other symptoms. So olanzapine and risperidone have both been shown beneficial in dementia, risperidone for psychosis, olanzapine for agitation. Quetiapine, again, hasn't shown much for the psychosis, but can be helpful in agitation. And aripiprazole is gaining some recognition as being qualified to treat agitation and psychosis in dementia. But, of course, there's the other side to the story, which is that antipsychotics in people with dementia increase the rates of sudden death and of stroke. We're talking about a doubling of those rates, but the doubling still puts us under about 5% per year of those. So you really have to be careful to warn your patients, warn your families that yes, these can be, not always, can be effective treatments. However, they do come with these risks, and it's not just the risks of sudden death and stroke, but as you can see there, antipsychotics increase the risk of hospitalization for any cause within 30 days after starting, and it about triples that risk. So these are not minor effects to worry about. So we want to try and use lowest dose possible, shortest duration possible. Make sure to inform patients and families. And if you can, stop the treatment when the symptom goes away. There are some studies that have shown a high relapse rate if you stop antipsychotics after 4 to 8 months. You stop them and you'll still see return of psychosis. But another meta-analysis showed that there was no difference from placebo. Yes, you have a relapse rate with antipsychotics, a relapse rate with placebo, but there's really no difference if you withdraw either of them. Of course, besides those effects, there are the ones that we were all taught about in medical school, extrapyramidal syndromes. So that is dystonia or akathisia or Parkinsonism. Also, their physiologic parameters, all of these tend to increase blood glucose and can actually put some people into a diabetic state, certainly can make their diabetes harder to control. And they also, a lot of them also have alpha-1 and beta blockade. So they'll make people bradycardic, hypotensive, and they tend to be weight gainers. If you can, objective measures of the behaviors are ideal so that you can really take stock of how much these medications are doing for the patient, as opposed to a more sort of impressionistic view. So psychosis, although it is a very dramatic and serious problem, is actually quite common. About 50% of people with Alzheimer's disease will get psychosis symptoms, 80% of those with Lewy body, and 30% in Parkinson's disease. When you add these up, there are actually more people with dementia-related psychosis in the United States than there are with schizophrenia. Now, we know all the drugs that have been approved for schizophrenia, right? We only have one drug approved by the FDA to treat psychosis, and it's only psychosis in one of these, Parkinson's disease psychosis, for all of these 3.85 million people. It's important that when we think about treating psychosis in dementia, that we evaluate what our target goals are, why are we treating this psychosis, and then also evaluate both the internal, so that means electrolytes, hydration status, and external, lighting, stimulation, both the internal and external contributors to psychosis. The antipsychotics, as their name implies, can be effective against psychosis, even in dementia, but they are risky in this population. And so that's why it's so important to assess the goals of treatment, as well as anything else you can do non-pharmacologically. And now, LiveMe will be happy to take any questions that any of you have. Thanks very much.
Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you, Dr. Nguyen, for that very insightful presentation. We have Dr. Nguyen live here, and we have a few questions in the chat. I see there's a very active conversation going on between Dr. Nguyen and our participants. So let's get to one you did not answer. Let's see. In the possibly rare case that an older adult with MCI or mild dementia is taking Ritalin or a similar stimulant, could this class of medication cause psychosis in dementia?
Yeah, good question. So dementia, probably not. You wouldn't expect stimulants to cause cognitive decline. Psychosis, perhaps. You know, we often identify the stimulants as potentially psychosis-inducing because of their similarity to some of the drugs of abuse that can cause psychosis. But the actual likelihood of psychosis in someone who is using stimulants at typical doses is quite low. So if I started someone on a stimulant and they developed hallucinations or delusions, I would certainly think about the stimulant maybe more as a provoking factor than a causative factor, because again, it's not likely in routine doses that stimulants are going to cause either delusions or hallucinations.
Okay, thank you. What are your thoughts about terminal or paradoxical lucidity?
Paradoxical. Terminal or paradoxical lucidity?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, Robert, do you want to explain? I have another question.
Okay.
How significant is the hyperglycemia? The hyperglycemia in patients with both diabetes and DAT. I'm not sure what DAT is.
Dementia of the Alzheimer type, perhaps?
Yeah.
So I guess the question is whether having diabetes increases the likelihood of psychosis in Alzheimer type dementia. I don't know of data that suggests that that is the case. And I'm trying to think of any other medical conditions that increase the likelihood of hallucinations in Alzheimer disease outside of other degenerative disorders. Not that I know of. I would say that you're more likely probably to see delirium in someone with Alzheimer's disease who has diabetes because of the risk of hypo and hyperglycemia in those patients, because of the increased risk of infections in those patients and other illnesses that come along with diabetes. So I guess the the sum of it is essentially what I said in the talk. You know, if you have someone with Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, who develops hallucinations, particularly if that occurs over a relatively rapid period of time and there's any altered sensorium, look for causes of delirium.
Okay. Deborah Burke continues her questioning about, and I know I'm going to mangle this word, aripiprazole. Continuing on her query, so the likelihood of hallucinations is the same in both Parkinson's dementia as Lewy body dementia?
Approximately the same, yes.
Okay.
And same types of presentation, that hallucinations, and particularly visual hallucinations, tend to be substantially more common than delusions in both of those.
Okay. So Nelson William asked, I cared for a patient, and I know you answered this, but he had a follow-up. I cared for a patient with marked B12 deficiency, undetectable levels, without either hematological or apparent neurological disease, who required high dose of B12. Who over several years developed a rapid dementia, perhaps accelerated course because of high premorbid function. He was a retired pulmonologist. Then he asked, is there a syndrome that ties the two diagnoses together? B12.
Meaning the B12 deficiency, yeah, and this rapidly progressive dementia?
Yeah. I think that's what he
said. That's a really good question. So, I have a hard time completely excluding any contribution of earlier damage to someone's brain to a later degenerative disorder. It might be interesting to know that in people with B12 who develop dementia or cognitive decline while on B12, although returning the B12 to normal can help with a lot of symptoms, I think the latest data are that more often than not, the cognition itself doesn't return to normal, which suggests that perhaps severe B12 deficiency causes some permanent injury. So in this particular case, perhaps the B12 injury was there. This individual with pretty good cognitive reserve was able to tolerate that. But when the additional load of a degenerative disorder was placed on him, or the additional load of something else was placed on him, he declined very rapidly because he had a brain that was left vulnerable, left open by the earlier B12 deficiency. So that's how I might tie those together.
Okay. So let's go back to Robert's question about terminal lucidity or paradoxical lucidity. What he means by that is reports that people with dementia suddenly clear up soon before death. And he said, see Michael Nans or George, yeah, Mashour et al.
Yeah, so, and was the question for an explanation for that?
He says, what are your thoughts about that? That dementia clears up before death.
It is shocking and stunning to see, and I've seen it many times. I have no idea how to explain that. Perhaps, and this is going way, way out on a theoretical limb, as the body and brain approach death, perhaps there's a last gasp effort to expend a lot of energy in order to stave off death, and that helps to sharpen up alertness, awareness, cognition. As happens when our bodies and brains are faced with any kind of danger, there's a tendency for us to sharpen up. So maybe it's related to that. I don't know. Some people, I think, believe that something gets unlocked as people approach death, and perhaps if we could unlock that earlier, we would help them function better before that period of terminal lucidity. But I don't have a good explanation for it, or at least a testable explanation for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is your recommendation for environment modification to keep dementia psychosis patients at home?
So I think one key is to start with, again, the goals of treatment. So, keeping them at home doesn't necessarily mean eliminating the psychosis, but most of the time when psychosis drives someone out of the home, it's because of their response to it. And probably the number one response that sends them somewhere else is a violent or aggressive response. Reduce the number of things that are harmful that they could use. If you're thinking about how to reduce the psychosis, it's the same things that I said, reduce environmental ambiguities, increase the amount of true stimulation so that there's kind of less for the brain to play with in terms of ambiguity and time without stimulation. And make sure that you're evaluating for medical conditions and also other psychiatric conditions that can either push the psychotic phenomena or make the psychotic phenomena more uncomfortable or more unsafe for the patient.
Okay, very good. I am going to end the questioning there. I think most of them have been answered. I know you have somewhere to be right now, and wish Saria luck.
Thank you.
Okay.